Hello and welcome to the Stoic Conversations. I'm your host, Massimo Pilucci from the City College of New York, and here's my co-host, Rob Coulter from the University of Wyoming. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Massimo. Hi, everybody else. Glad to see people here today.
Yeah, this is the first time that we don't do our usual spot on Sunday afternoons, so we're going to experiment with different time zones and time frames and dates and all that sort of stuff. But so far, we are on track for publishing the audio version of the podcast on Thursday mornings. So stay tuned. This episode will come up next Thursday. Now, before we get into this episode, let me announce the next one, which it will take place on Tuesday, September 14th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Again, different day, different time. We will talk to our friend Ben Walker, originator of the CRITO project to teach philosophy and Stoicism in particular to prison inmates. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. If you'd like to register for that live show, go to meetup.com and look for Stoic School. And if you wish to hear past podcasts, episodes of the Stoic Conversations, go to anchor.fm/Stoic Meditations. Today, we have a really interesting, fascinating guest, Robin Waterfield, who is joining us from Greece. And we'll talk about his, among other things, his most recent translation and annotation of Marcus Aurelius' Meditations. Robin is an independent scholar and translator who, as I said, lives with his wife, the writer, Catherine Waterfield, on a small olive farm in southern Greece, Lycaeum. Most recently, he has translated, as I just said, and annotated Marcus Aurelius' Meditations. Robin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
All right, Rob, you're up for the first question.
Sounds great. Yeah, again, Robin, thanks so much for joining us. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation. And I've mentioned before we got recording, that I'd been reading your translations for, well, frankly, decades now. But this is a neat opportunity, I think. I'd like to start by talking a little bit about translation in general, right? I've not produced a translation, but I read Greek, and I suspect most of our audience today is Greekless. So not quite sure how we're going to manage this, but I'd like to know if we could peel back the curtain a little bit about how you think about translating. And I thought we could just pick an example, and that's Meditations 10:16, which is a pretty famous example. You translate it as, "No more abstract discussions about what a good man is like, just be one." And I think many of us here are familiar with that quote. And I was wondering if you could tell us something about how you think about translating that from the Greek, and maybe we could compare some of the other translations that are pretty commonly read as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, this is a short entry, and the Greek is fairly straightforward. So in that case, I would probably just plunge in. I mean, my Greek is fluent enough that I would just plunge in and translate it. The first version I come up with is extremely unlikely to be the final version. I'm constantly tweaking all my work, whether it's translations or other forms of writing. But so you just break the sentence up. Here we've got Merketh. Merketh holos peritu choion tina enaiton agathon andra dialegestai ala enaito yuton. You've got Merketh, which means not yet, and it's followed by imperatives. So, no longer, I mean, not yet, no longer do something. So I often translate that as stop doing something. I'm always looking for different, more fluent English ways of expressing things. By the way, the Hayes translation, which you sent me a copy of this, I don't know the translation, but he doesn't seem to be aware that we've got two infinitives here in this sentence, but they are infinitives being used as imperatives, whereas he's translated them as infinitives. So I'm not sure he's aware of the fact that the Greek infinitive can be used as an imperative. I don't know the man, I don't know how good his Greek is, but there you go. So here we've got no longer with two imperatives, no longer dialegestai, no longer talk, that's the word from which we get dialectic, ultimately. It means to have a conversation. No longer talk, peri tu hoyontin enaiton, about what kind of person the good man is, right? That's literally. And then ala enaiton, but be such.
Yep.
And that's literally. No longer talk about what the good man is like, but be such. Now there's one, so that's how we get my translation, which is pretty much similar to Robin Hard's translation, except I haven't commented on one word yet. The second word is hollows. And this is a very difficult word in Greek for me as a translator, because it has a wide range of meaning. It literally means holy. It's the adverb of the adjective holos, which means whole. So it means holy, altogether, but then it also means on the whole, or in general, or even in short. All right. So you look at this range of meanings and you decide what it can possibly mean here. And I took it to mean in general, and I translated that as abstract. So that's how you get to my translation. No more abstract discussions about what a good man is like. Just be one.
So do you think then that... So when I compare that to, say, Robin Hard's, what do you think he's doing with the holos? Do you think that's the no more of all this talk? Or?
Yeah, I think he's put in the all.
And so why do you think your version maybe captures Marcus a little bit better than, I mean, you mentioned one sort of criticism of Hayes about the use of infinitives as imperatives, but any other things?
No, I don't think it necessarily captures it better than Robin Hard's translation or maybe even one or two others. I mean, what, you know, when a book has been translated this often, there are going to be no revolutions. You know, my translation is going to look extremely similar to other people's translations. But what you get from each different translator is a slightly different feel. Mine are generally more kind of like conversational. And particularly since I was thinking all the time about how the fact that Marcus was writing notebooks, and when you write notebooks, you tend to write pretty fast. And so I tried to convey that by using ellipses in English, not writing "it is" as you normally would for nonfiction, but writing "it's," not writing "that is," but writing "that's," and so on and so forth. I used that as a way of trying to convey the speed of Marcus jotting down his ideas in notebooks. So it's the overall feel. My Marcus is perhaps slightly more, I hope, slightly more accessible, slightly more user-friendly than others. But obviously I feel my translation is more accurate at certain points, otherwise I wouldn't bother doing it. But nevertheless, in general, most Marcus translations look pretty much the same.
Well, do you want me to follow up on this one, Massimo?
Yeah, go ahead. You have a follow-up on that, so go ahead.
Yeah, I have a follow-up also on this passage, and one of the reasons I chose it was to connect it to your introduction, which I really liked your introduction. I thought it was very very clear, very accessible, while not shying away from some difficult questions.
Yeah.
One of which you poked up, you pointed up about this passage, where you suggest that in this passage, Marcus, as you put it, is he scorns philosophizing even about ethical matters, right? And so this sort of points to the nature of the meditations and Marcus's, what Marcus is trying to accomplish and all of that. But so sometimes this passage is read as you put it, scorning philosophical investigation, or theoretical philosophical investigation anyway. But there's also another interpretation out there, and that is that this passage, Marcus is really talking to himself as someone who's already done a lot of theoretical investigation through his life. And he's not scorning it in general. Rather, he's saying there comes a point at which you've done enough. And for him, that's actually quite a lot. So I wondered if you had something to say about those.
No, I think you're perfectly right, Rob. I think that's exactly the way to read it, and I think that is, in a sense, the way I am reading it. He's done a lot of reading. He's done a lot of thinking, and in this particular entry, he's now saying, "Enough of that. You know, just try to be one." But there is a more general issue here, which I wasn't actually aware of until relatively recently, which is that there seem to be two camps about how people read Marcus. Some people judge him to be an enlightened sage, to have done it all, to be there. But that's not how I read him at all. I read the whole book. And for me, this is exactly why the book speaks to me, and I think why the book speaks to so many people. I read the whole book as him, as an aspirant. And we're all aspirants. None of us would call ourselves enlightened sages. We're all aspirants, and that's how the book speaks to us. So this to me, this 1016 is just one of those places where Marcus is saying, you know, I can do better. I've got to put it into practice. And the only way to be better is to put it in practice, not just to think about things. And I don't think, you know, some people want to call him a philosopher king because he was, you know, the emperor of Rome, the richest and most powerful man in the world by far. I don't know what was happening in China, actually, so I probably shouldn't say the world.
But at least the Mediterranean world, that's for sure.
Mediterranean world, for sure. But I mean, let's look at 8.1. I'm just going to read a bit of 8.1. Another thing that will help you curb your tendency towards self-importance is the fact that you no longer have the opportunity to live your whole life, or at least your adult life, as a philosopher. In fact, it's obvious to a great many people, not just yourself, that you're a long way off being a philosopher. You're neither one thing nor the other. I mean, this isn't Marcus talking as an enlightened person, as a philosopher king. This is Marcus talking as somebody who knows there's always further to go. There's always more work on oneself to do. And that's very much how I read Marcus throughout.
Yeah, and yeah, I am inclined to agree with you wholly on that point. I mean, I think sometimes the 1016 passage is sometimes read as saying, don't bother doing any of the theoretical stuff, just be a good man. And I think that's a mistake.
That's not what I was trying to say. That would be a mistake,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm trying to say.
Yeah,
and actually, Epictetus's message is very strongly the same as well. Throughout, he's always saying, you know, okay, you read the books, now throw them away.
yeah.
That's right. And in fact, even Epictetus's teacher, Musonius Rufus, puts a lot of emphasis on the practice. But as you two have been talking about, this doesn't mean that the theory is not important. It just means that either you've done the theory or you're familiar enough with the theory that now you need to focus on the practice. Too often I see even modern Stoic practitioners reading that specific passage that you guys have been talking about as saying, oh, you know, we don't need the practice, you don't need to read books. It's like, no, that's not true, because without the theory, you do not know what the practice is supposed to be. But if you're talking about, proportions, you should, I suppose, be, you know, nine parts practice and one part theory or something like that. And after you've done enough theory, then you're good to go. You should do the practice. All right, Robin, let me zoom back up out in a little bit broader fashion in terms of your book. One of the interesting things to me, the value added, other than the really nice and insightful translation, is of course the notes. And you have a lot of notes. I mean, the title is, it's an annotated version of Marcus Aurelius. So just in general, can you tell us a little bit about how you decide what actually needs an expiratory note and what you can leave alone? You know, how do you make those kind of decisions as a translator?
Yeah, okay. Well, first let me say that writing an annotated version of translating an annotated version of Marcus wasn't my idea. That was the publisher's idea. I didn't approach them. They approached me and said, this is what we want. And I gulped and said, okay. How do I choose a note? Well, sometimes it's very easy. I mean, you've got things like, you know, he might refer to a passage from Plato. So I put a note in saying which passage of Plato it is.
Right.
He might mention a mythical or historical person. So I put a note in explaining who that person was and why it's relevant to be mentioned at that particular point. And then there's a whole bunch of other notes. I mean, especially in the case of a book like Meditations, where you know, there's no particular order. It's not a philosophically argued treatise going from A to B to C all the way through to Z. It's jottings, random jottings, whatever occurs to him to think about that day, that evening, after work, after battle, whatever it is. And so there's a third category of notes, which is very much a lot of kind of cross-referencing to where he's talking about the same issue in other books. And I didn't do that for every time, because otherwise, you know, there'd be nothing but a forest of notes and nobody would be able to see the text. But there was a certain amount of cross-referencing. Fourthly, it was one of my main functions, as I saw it in this book. I mean, many, many people read Marcus just for the pleasure of it and what they can, what sense they can get from it and how it can help them in their personal quest or whatever, whatever. But I felt it was important for me to point out that, and he is readable like that. I mean, you don't need to know Stoicism in order to appreciate Marcus. That's one of the great things about it. Again, Epictetus is different, but you really need to know Stoicism. But so for Marcus, I wanted to point out a whole category of notes of pointing out the Stoicism underlying what it is that he's saying. He might be saying something in very ordinary, accessible language, but it's actually imbued with Stoic theory. As we were saying a moment ago, he'd certainly done his theoretical reading. So I felt I should point that kind of thing out. And other than that, I mean, there's probably another category or two of looser things, just things that occur to me. I've written, as I said earlier, before we started, I've got, you know, over 30 translations out there, and they're all annotated to a greater or lesser extent. So you kind of pick up a kind of intuition as to what needs annotation or what you think needs annotation. But in a sense, it's a difficult choice, because what I might feel isn't totally obvious and needs annotation is not necessarily what anybody else is not going to find obvious and feel needs annotation. So you do the best to please as many people as possible.
As you mentioned, the meditation does not have an internal structure except for book one, which is this long list of people who to whom Marcus is grateful. So how would you suggest somebody approach the book, the text, for the first time? Read it cover to cover, opening in at random, or in some other way?
I actually do have a definite answer for that, because as I was translating, I noticed that book five was by far the most accessible book. It's no less imbued with Stoicism, but it's got far fewer use of technical terms, far fewer use of grandiose stuff. It's really, you know, down to the nitty-gritty and speaking to people directly. And I would recommend people to start with book five. But most people, for a lot of people, it seems to be like a bedtime book, not a bedtime book, I mean a bedside book. So they pick it up and they read a couple of entries and mull what they've read and things like that. It's worth reading from cover to cover, I think, but that's not necessarily that I'm recommending it. I just think it's worth reading cover to cover to make sure you don't miss anything, because there's so much good stuff in it.
Right. Rob, I think you have the next question up.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the introduction, and you say something there about this kind of vexed question about indifference.
Yeah.
Things that are indifferent. And a lot of sort of modern Stoics and people who are approaching Stoicism for the first time get sort of puzzled by this, right? So just to sort of remind everybody, right, the only thing that's truly morally good is virtue or our virtuous activities. And everything else is indifferent, right? Meaning isn't morally good, sort of morally neutral in some way, but the Stoics say some are preferred and some are dispreferred. And the way you emphasize that distinction is you say that for preferred indifference, you say their value depends on whether they aid an aspirant's progress toward virtue. And I take it that you mean that that's what makes something preferred. Yes. There seems to be another school of thought that says, no, preferred things are, since they're indifferent, it's just whatever we kind of happen to prefer, right? If I happen to like drinking a glass of wine on the veranda in the evening, then great, right? And that's just fine because it's indifferent. But your position seems to be quite a bit stronger than that about what makes something preferred or dispreferred. So I wondered if you could maybe articulate with this a little bit why you prefer that position.
I don't think I'm saying anything different from what you're saying. You're quite right. Things are preferred and dispreferred by us. Indifference are preferred by us simply because they correspond to our human nature. We naturally prefer health over sickness. We naturally prefer at least a moderate amount of wealth over, you know, begging on the street. These things correspond to our human nature. But so let me backtrack just a little bit and explain that in this introduction, I decided really to focus on virtue because I felt that was Marcus's focus. You know, he starts book two by with the famous Stoic point that the only good thing there is virtue, and the only bad thing there is moral imperfection. And that seems to me to be his core insight from which everything else kind of spreads out. So I kind of cut a bit of a corner here. Preferred indifference are preferred because they correspond to our human nature. But a life lived in accord with human nature is a life of virtue. So I simply missed out a step here, right? So preferred indifference are naturally preferred by us. But if we were to live in accordance with our nature, preferring the correct set of indifference, we would be closer to living a virtuous life. So I kind of elided a bit there, but because, as I say, I wanted to stress virtue. But otherwise, I think the positions are essentially the same.
And are they essentially the same? Are they essentially the same on your view? Because of that, when they correspond in the case of the truly virtuous person, then just what they happen to prefer happens to be what is in agreement with nature writ large and human nature.
That is the goal. That's the Stoic sage. Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
I'd like to make a comment about that. No, that's okay. Because that actually is an interesting point in general. It comes up often in discussions of the so-called preferred and dispreferred indifference. And on the one hand, there are clear passages, for instance, in Seneca, where he says, for instance, pleasure is in agreement with nature and pain is against nature, meaning just what Robin says, that pleasure is something that we naturally seek, and pain is something that we naturally try to stay away from. However, there's also passages in the Stoic text, and I think it's a reasonable interpretation, that even those things are actually conditional, because what actually makes an indifferent, preferred or dispreferred, is to some extent what you do with it. And so that, you know, to, for instance, if you're talking about a tyrant, well, his health, from the point of view of the rest of us, is not preferred, it's dispreferred. You want the tyrant to die as soon as possible because he's a tyrant. And of course, if you use your wealth, let's say, which is typically classed under the preferred indifference, but if you acquire that wealth in a way that exploits other people, and then you use it in order to oppress other people, then it's not preferred because you're making a bad use of it, right? So it's really interesting to think about this thing. Yeah, go ahead. Yep, go for it.
I'm trying to recapture an insight. I mean, a tyrant's wealth is still preferred by the tyrant.
Sure.
That's the point. Wow. What we think about it, that's entirely up to us. That's nothing to do with the tyrant. And what was I going to go on to say after that? Yeah, because the point is that even preferred indifference are still indifferent. They are still indifferent. They should not make the slightest bit of difference to anything, to our contentment, to our happiness, to our serenity. Whether we have them or whether we don't have them, ultimately, whether they're preferred or dispreferred, should not make the slightest difference. Otherwise, sure. Otherwise you're an Aristotelian.
Right. Wouldn't you say that a tyrant is probably an Aristotelian? I mean, if he probably does.
He might well be. Yes. He might well be. Certainly not a Platonist, anyway.
Not a Platonist. That's right. Okay. Before we go ahead, and I'm going to ask the next question. I want to actually. This is the time to remind the audience that if you have a question for Robin, you can post it in the chat at this point, and Rob and I. We'll look at it and pick some good questions if there are from the audience. But in the meantime, Robin, I want to get a little bit more personal in the sense that, you know, I assume that once you spent a significant amount of time translating Marcus Aurelius, you got something from that experience, not just as a translator, but as a human being, right? So what does Marcus say to you? What is it that you take out of this experience other than the professional experience as a translator? Or does it? Because, you know, maybe I'm just assuming that it does, but it may not.
No, in fact, really, it doesn't. As a translator, I remain very aloof. I embed myself in the text and I get to know each author that I translate as intimately as you like. I'm not affected personally by what I translate because I'm just the translator. I'm just trying to do the best job I can to act as a megaphone for that person to get his or her thoughts down in English, in the best English I can. And that my focus is so much on that, on the art of translating, on the task of translating, that I don't really let authors affect me that much. And there's actually, I think any translator will tell you there's a very good reason for that. Because suppose I'm not, for instance, a practicing Stoic, but suppose I were a practicing Stoic, then I would, as a translator, there would be a tendency, regrettable tendency, for me to try to read Marcus through my understanding of Stoicism, which is exactly the wrong thing for a translator to do. And I found time and time again over my career as a translator, dating back now, God, almost 40 years. I found time and again that when there are passages which I don't understand, and which therefore I'm inclining to put my own understanding on, I have to stand back again and just translate what I see, just translate the words that I see, even if I can't make sense of them at the time. And then later when I come back to it, maybe I'll understand it, maybe I'll see that what Plato or Marcus or whoever said was exactly right after all. It's just that I wasn't understanding it at the time. So no, as a translator, I try not to be influenced in that kind of way by the people, by the kind of way that you're suggesting, by the people that I translate.
I suppose in some sense, this may not be that different from, let's say, a biographer who also is supposed not to get too involved with the subject of his or her biography, because otherwise, you don't write a interesting, objective biography. You just write either a very positive or a very negative treatment of your subject matter, which I've seen. I've seen, in fact.
I've seen it too.
You know, and
I did a biography quite a while ago of Khalil Gibran, you know, the author of The Prophet and various other books. And, you know, other biographies around of him aren't biographies, they're hagiographies.
Right, yes, exactly. And, but at the same time, you, as a translator, you pick certain subjects and you pick certain books. So, you know, why, for instance, Marcus Aurelius as opposed to, you know, anything else? Or why Marcus Aurelius at this particular point in your career? Or was that just the logical next step? It's like, well, I haven't done Marcus, so he's up.
No, like I told you, it was the publishers who approached me.
Okay.
I hadn't thought of doing Marcus.
And did that surprise you? What kind of reaction did you have? Was that like, oh, this is a great idea, why didn't I think about it? Or like, oh, okay, I guess I have to do this.
No, it was a combination of fear, because I mean, it's a pretty awesome thing to translate a book as important as the Meditations. And fear also because, although my knowledge of Stoicism, you know, I've been a student of ancient philosophy since my 20s, I guess. Mm-hmm. So although my knowledge of Stoicism was considerably better than most, I wasn't an expert in Stoicism. So I had quite a lot of work to do before writing the introduction, for instance, to bring myself up to speed on Stoicism. I think I did okay. The reactions from professional, you know, professors at universities and things have been all positive. So I think I did okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that would be my thought as well. Rob, did you want to pick something from the audience?
Yeah, I'd like to ask you this question that Greg Lopez has, which I think is a great question. He notes that earlier in the conversation, you were talking about Marcus's writing notebooks being sort of a quick writing quickly at times and things like that. And Greg notes that seems to be in tension with what, for example, Pierre Hadot says about Marcus's practice as being, well-crafted language, well thought out, and maybe having thought about things a lot of times before he actually committed it to paper. So what Greg asks is, what makes you disagree with Hadot's picture? And I think this is a kind of a, is it linguistic, right? Does his Greek come off to you as quick and informal, or is it about the construction of the text as a whole, or does that make sense?
I think the overall impression of the text is one of randomness. There are clusters when particular issues were occupying Marcus's mind, but the overall impression is one of randomness. But Greg's quite right. I mean, you know, anybody who reads the book can see that some entries are very carefully thought out. One thinks, I don't know, that entry, that mini essay on old comedy, middle comedy, new comedy, and those sorts of things. Yeah. And one of my favorite passages in Marcus is a very carefully constructed sentence written by a master of the language and really in full control of his language. But a lot of the other entries are quick jottings. And it's difficult in English to convey that, because Marcus might write something completely ungrammatical, just two words without a verb. But when you're translating, you have to supply a verb. You have to guess which verb it is and put it in and things like that. So there are some which are speedier than others, let's say, Greg. Yeah. So you're right. A more balanced view would say both that there are both sorts of entries, the carefully polished ones and the less polished ones. But I say carefully polished, but I'm not sure how much polishing he did. I still think he just wrote them down. I just think he was an incredibly highly educated man, an incredibly intelligent man. And only anybody who tries to write finds that some sentences or even some paragraphs just come out well the first time you put pen to paper. So I'm not sure whether he was crafting even those entries that read better, or whether he was just a talented writer so that they came out right.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I'm going to ask Ben's question from the chat. He says, I have a great difficulty grasping how Marcus and Epictetus, and we'll talk about Epictetus in a few minutes, use the terms God, gods, Zeus, and providence. At times, the terms seem interchangeable, but there must be a reason why they choose one or the other in a particular statement. What do you think? Is there a reason why they do so, or are they actually truly interchangeable?
I think they're truly interchangeable. If there is a reason, I haven't found it. It's actually such a good question that I want to go back now and see if one can find a reason. I mean, you could write an academic paper on this very easily. I mean, sometimes I think Marcus and Epictetus use God or the gods when they're talking about something more personal. No, that's not the case either, because they do the same with providence. Providence is no. I think they're completely interchangeable. That's my view.
That would agree with my understanding of Stoic theory. In fact, Diogenes Laertius explicitly says that the early Stoics use those terms interchangeably. That right. Nature is God, is providence, etc. So I would agree with your take on this.
Yeah, can I just follow up real quick? I don't know the answer to this at all, or don't have a view about it. Are there passages in Marcus, say, since you've fairly recently been spending some extended time with him, where maybe the Greek is ambiguous about how you might translate it on that issue, right? God or Zeus, for example, or is it always just you're just reading right off the text when you do it?
Always reading right off the text. If the word was theoi, I translated gods. If it was theos, I translated God. If it was Zeus, okay, I translated Zeus, etc., etc.
And you can't recall any cases where it was kind of ambiguous or where you had to make a choice. Okay.
No.
Now, I probably should have asked this earlier on, but there is an obvious question, I guess, for a translator. Again, you spent a significant amount of time with Marcus, and even though you say, you know, you're not a Stoic and you're trying to not be affected sort of personally, nevertheless, there might be some passages in particular that struck you as interesting or meaningful, whatever it is, right? So what are one or two of your favorite in that respect?
All right, I'm going to read some of 12:3. This is the passage I alluded to a little earlier. I mean, this is what I said earlier was this was just a masterful sentence, and it really is a masterful sentence. If you separate from yourself, that is from your mind, all that other people do or say, all that you yourself have done or said, all that disturbs your peace of mind as looming in the future, all the properties of the body that encases you or of the spirit that is embedded in it that are not subject to your volition, and all that swirls around you, driven by the whirlwind of the external world, until your mind has been released from the bonds of fate and lives purified, untrammeled, on its own, doing what is right, willingly accepting everything that happens and speaking the truth. If, I say, you detach your command center from what has become attached to it as a result of its being attracted by bodily feelings, and from all that is to come and all that has gone, and make yourself, in Empedocles' words, a rounded sphere rejoicing in encircling solitude, and train yourself to live the only life you have, that is, in the present moment, you'll be able to pass what remains of your life, up until your death, with a mind that is tranquil in itself, kind to others, and at peace with your guardian spirit. This is truly remarkable. I mean, that is a huge long sentence, and I was delighted to be able to find a way to translate it as a single sentence, because normally as a translator, I break up these long Greek sentences. But huge long sentence, but perfectly clear. Every step of the way, perfectly clear. So going back to Greg's point, this is somebody who's, as I say, I'm not sure how much he thought about it, but it came out perfectly. It's wonderful philosophy, and it's wonderful writing as well. So I really, that's I think my most favorite passage in all the book. But let me pick on another one, I might throw the question back at you. This is from 5:8. There are two reasons then why you should gladly accept whatever happens to you. First, because the experience happened to you, was prescribed for you, and was the product of a web somehow woven just for you way back in time out of the most ancient causes. Now, what struck me about that, if you could genuinely live your life that way, if you could genuinely live your life knowing that every situation you were in, every split second even of the day was designed for you alone by a benevolent and providential God or an impersonal force, call it providence, it doesn't matter. If you could truly believe that and live from that, your world would be full of meaning. You would be living in a large and meaningful and rich universe all the time. I don't know whether anybody's here familiar with the writings of Castaneda, Carlos Castaneda, back in the 70s. He has a very, very similar exercise called having to believe, where Don Juan says, you have to believe that every situation you find yourself in has been created by you, by your personal power, for you and for you alone. And that's very much the same kind of Castaneda, I believe, was very eclectic. He took bits from all over the place. I believe it to be fiction, not fact, and he took bits from all over the place. But I think he might well have taken that from Stoicism.
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. So I think there are two ways, however, to interpret the notion of providence here, right? So one is a little bit more of a what I normally think of as a Christian take on providence, that is, that things do happen to you because somebody or the cosmic forces or whatever it is are really in fact concerned about you specifically, or they're designing something about you specifically. The other one is the one that I take, and which is the one that I prefer, is the one that I take when I read, for instance, Epictetus talking about the fact that you are a foot that is connected to a body and you have to step into the mud, right? I love that analogy. And now
comes from Chrysippus.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. So it's an early Stoic analogy. And so I take that to mean that it's not like the body necessarily, you know, the larger universe is in this case, the body. It's not that it's concerned about what happens to the foot. And it's not necessarily that whatever happens to the foot is best for the foot, because, you know, stepping in the mud, it's rather unpleasant. But what it is the foot is connected to a full body. And if it realized that, then it would not only not mind, but in fact embrace the notion of stepping into the mud, because he's doing his duty, he's helping the body, right? So if you see it from that perspective, then what happens to me isn't necessarily good for me, but it is good for the universe. Even if I die, or if one of my loved ones die, then this is something that it's actually helping somehow. Of course, I don't know exactly how, but it's helping the cosmic organism. And that does provide some meaning and some relief from my individual fate. What do you think? Yeah, Rob is.
I think you've got the emphasis slightly wrong there, because remember that bit in Marcus? I think it's in Marcus, not Epictetus, where he goes through all the different views of God. You can either think there is no God, or you can think there is a God, but he doesn't really do anything in relation to the universe. Or you can think there is a God, and he does good, but only at the broadest level. Or you can think there is a God, and he actually cares for mankind as a whole. Or you can think there is a God, and he cares for each of us personally. And it's that latter view that Marcus goes for, that there is a providential, benevolent God, and he cares for each of us personally. So he cares for the foot, not just the body.
Yeah. However, that the question is that the Stoic position, or is that Marcus that is interpreting things or mixing things? We know that he was also a very religious person.
Yeah, that's a nice question.
Yeah, it's a broader question. Yeah. Rob, did you have a comment on this particular thing, or?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is something Massimo, you and I have had multiple conversations about, and I don't think our views are that far apart. But I was struck, Robin, when you described this passage as all of these things that happen to you are for me alone. For example, if I'm just the one there, and I think there's two ways to read that alone. One of which is to think that I'm somehow special and different, right? It's just for me and not for anybody else. But I think it's really important for the Stoic picture to see that it's everything that happens to me is just for me, just as it is for anyone else, right? So all the things that happen to you are just for you as well. And we're all equally part of this giant sort of web of causation, as some of the earlier Stoics sometimes talked about it. And I think that's important to get that sort of emphasis in it. So back to the foot example. I may be a foot today, but there's another foot too. And there's knees and elbows, and they've got their stuff too. And the whole universe is in this funny way, causally connected to all of it in a way that makes nothing sort of more or less valuable. I guess that's
we're all special, but because we're interconnected. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Robin, I heard, because I think you told me that your next project was Epictetus. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Where is that, and what kind of sort of challenges or differences you found in terms of approaching Epictetus as opposed to Marcus?
Okay. Well, let me say first that this is going to be published by the University of Chicago Press, so it's a slightly more academic book. It's again fairly heavily annotated, perhaps not quite so much pro rata as the Marcus translation, but it's fairly heavily annotated. But the annotations tend to be more scholarly and just a tad more scholarly all the way through. The differences between the two of them are enormous. Epictetus is, well, for a start, it's very long. There's a lot of it, and it's very dense, and a lot of it is extremely difficult to get right in translation. In so many ways, but particularly because, one of the chief differences between the two is that Marcus was an amateur philosopher, Whereas Epictetus was a professional philosopher, he was a teacher of philosophy. So he is using technical terms, Stoic technical terms, far more liberally than Marcus is. Marcus tends to use ordinary language as much as I mean, he throws in the odd technical term, but it's not like Epictetus, where the focus is always on the technical term and what it means. So you have to get those technical terms right, and that's extremely difficult. I mean, we have impulses. That's a common translation of a Greek word, hormone, is impulse, all right? Because it's what leads to action. But, you know, and that's a common translation, but it's not right, because impulse in English sounds like impulsiveness. It sounds like you're acting on whim or something like that. Some people recently have been inclined towards motivation, but I don't think that's quite right either. And the other thing that's extremely difficult about Epictetus is he talks about things in pairs. So he talks about hormere, impulse, and aphormere, which is the opposite, an impulse away from, an impulse towards, as opposed to an impulse away from. And he uses just one word each time, but it's very difficult to capture these things in one word in English. So translating Epictetus was far more of a struggle, far more of a brain ache at the end of the day than translating Marcus. And Epictetus also is not...
Sorry, that's a very good example, because every time that I have to explain what impulse means, I have exactly this problem, because in English, as you pointed out, that's just not the right word at all. So I'm curious at this point, is how did you end up translating it at the end?
Inclination and disinclination. Yeah. It's not perfect, but I don't think anything is going to be perfect. But I went for inclination and disinclination, because that way I could easily capture this pairing, former, aformer, right, with single English words as well. And that, you know, helps to communicate the speed with which Epictetus is a very rapid speaker. And if you have to sort of slow things down by saying things like, I mean, he uses one word, which we have to translate in English as seeking to avoid the things that you don't want to meet. That's one word in Greek. So as a translator, I want to try to get as close to translating one word as one word in order to capture the speed with which he's talking. And this is another big difference, of course, between Epictetus and Marcus, is that Epictetus was giving live talks, whereas Marcus was writing. And so the difficulty in translating Marcus is occasionally because of the density, the condensedness of his Greek. But the difficulty in translating Epictetus is to know what tone of voice he's using. Because these are only, you know, transcribed talks. Sometimes he's being sarcastic, sometimes he's being ironic. And if you translate it in such a way that irony comes out, it's quite different. It has quite different meaning from if you translate it without having irony come out, you know. So it's really, really, it was a challenge. It was a real challenge.
When is the new book, the new translation coming out? Do you know already?
Well, there's been a lot of delay, largely because of COVID and one or two delays generated by the publisher themselves, but usually due to COVID. So really, it's only just entered production now, so it should be out sometime next year.
Okay, great. And it is the comprehensive, meaning the discourses and Caridion and fragments, or just the discourses? Or
no, all three.
All three. Okay, great. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. We're going to go back to one question from the audience. This is from Claudia. And it goes back to the issue of what it means to be a translator, which apparently fascinates several people. And that's one of the reasons we have you here. You said you see yourself as a megaphone for the author. What it implies to me is that translation necessitates the translator to leave him or herself out of the text. I'm interested in the art of translation, in essence, of the translator. Where do you see your art to be? Asked maybe in another way, where or who are you in relation to the text? And I ask that question, says Claudia, because I find I do really like some translators' work and others far less. And so clearly, even though the text is the same, something happens there, the level of sort of personality or approach. Yeah, so what your comment on that?
No, Claudia is quite right. Yes, ideally I would not be in the way. I would be translating at the moment, I'm you know, I'd be translating Marcus, I'd be translating Plato, I'd be translating Herodotus, and the tone of voice, the ultimate finished product, would be completely different in all three cases, but it never is. There's always a bit of me in it. As I said earlier, my style of translation, I think at least partly gained because I, you know, grew up, I started really translating Plato's works. They're very conversational. So my style of translation became quite accessible, conversational, easygoing. You know, obviously I had to change that when my original author isn't being easygoing or whatever, and I have to do my best with that. And the other thing that I'm told I'm good at is capturing different registers of the texts. I mean, Plato, for instance, is sometimes sublime and sometimes very down to earth and often somewhere in between. And so one has to try to capture those differences as well. Where am I in relation to the text? I don't know, embedded in it.
Yeah, that's
really what it feels like. You it takes a good, you know, I have to make proposals for publishers when I do a translation, and it's always difficult because I give them a bit of sample translation, but I know it's not going to look like that in the end, because it takes me at least till I'm 10% of the way through the work before I feel that I'm embedded enough in it that I know my author well enough. It's almost like a sort of, you get this peculiar kind of intimacy with the people you're translating. It's never uncomfortable. It's just there. It's just part of what the job is. But yeah, I'm embedded in it, and just trying to be, therefore, the mouthpiece for whichever author it is. But it's never going to be 100%.
A number of the things that you've just said prompt me to sort of ask this question: of all the things you've translated, what's your favorite and what's your least favorite?
my favorite is always the most recent one I've done.
Because you're so embedded in it, I suppose.
Yeah, but I do have a least favorite. I was once asked to translate some of Euripides' plays. I did two volumes of Euripides' plays, and I shouldn't. I'm not a poet. And it really, you know, poetry really, really should be translated by somebody who is a poet as well as a translator. They're okay as translations. They're okay, but I'd have liked to have done better, and I couldn't because I'm not a poet. So those are my least favorites, but everything else is my favorite.
Wonderful. Hey, one more from the audience. Joseph asks, and this is about the Epicurean versus Stoic views of the universe. Mm-hmm. And he mentions, particularly, you have a note to 610, in which scholars seem to be go back and forth about whether or not Marcus is undecided about what view of the universe to have.
Oh, yeah,
And not. And you seem to come down pretty strongly on the view that he's not undecided.
I absolutely don't read any indecision into any of those places. Sometimes he's overt immediately goes on to reject the Epicurean view. Sometimes he just says things like, I don't know, remind yourself, either order or random atoms. He just says something like that without apparently deciding on one or the other. But we already know which way his decision goes, I think. So I don't think there's ever any doubt. I don't think he's in the slightest attracted to Epicureanism. I think quite the opposite. I think he was very strongly opposed to it. I say at one point in the introduction that one of the ways the Stoics saw badness coming in people was because they were stuck in this infantile view that of seeking pleasure and avoiding pain and not seeing any purpose to life beyond that. So I think Marcus was disgusted by Epicureanism in that sense, in the sense that it perpetuated this infantile way of approaching the world. And again, I would say the same with Epictetus as well.
Yeah, and not only the Stoics, but Cicero on the Epicureans, he's just as disgusted as Marcus or Epictetus. Well, we've done it again. We got to the end of the hour. And so this was a lot of fun. Robin, thanks for joining us all the way from Greece. I hope that the fires and the smoke are not too bad where you live at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, it is what it is. But it was a pleasure having you. I really enjoyed your translation of Marcus, and in fact several other works. As I was saying before the show, that I'm now rereading your treatment of the Pre-Socratics, and they're very exciting. So we will reconvene for the Stoic Conversations on Tuesday, September 14th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And we'll talk to our friend Ben Walker, originator of the Crider Project to teach philosophy and particularly Stoicism to prison inmates. And until then, stay safe.
And thanks you very everybody. Much. Thank you for your questions. Thank you for the opportunity. This was, I really enjoyed myself. I had no idea an hour had passed, for instance.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. And good to see everybody.
Bye-bye.